Today on Against the Grain, the proponents of cultured meat, meat grown in a laboratory that is, argue that it will not only put an end to the suffering of animals, but could lead us into a world free of the global warming effects of industrialized animal agriculture. I'm Sasha Lilly. Benjamin Wargaft joins me to talk about how the hopes for cultured meat refract many visions of the future, including avoiding deep changes to systems of production under capitalism. Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In 2013, a Dutch scientist caused a sensation by growing hamburger meat in a laboratory. The media speculated at the time that it would usher in an era where animals are no longer slaughtered for human consumption and where the planet-warming effects of animal production are curtailed. It's still not clear whether cultured meat is viable for large-scale production, but my guest argues that the aspirations and reactions to cultured meat tell us a lot about how we see ourselves, non-human nature, and the future. Writer and historian Benjamin Wargaft ponders these questions in his book, Meat Planet, Artificial Flesh, and the Future of Food, which is published by UC Press. He's visiting assistant professor of social studies and history at Wesleyan University. Ben, to the degree that such things can even be determined at this point, how feasible is the production of cultured meat for the general public?
The first thing to say is that laboratory-grown meat, as of this conversation, does not exist as a consumer product. That claim in and of itself may seem surprising, given the amount of journalistic hype that lab-grown meat has received ever since the Dutch scientist Mark Post did a kind of public demo of the world's first cell-cultured burger back in 2013. But as of now, there exist no lab-grown meat products specifically available to consumers such as ourselves. You can't go to Safeway and pick up a 4-pack of lab-grown burgers or a 6-pack of sausages. And the question of ultimate viability still hangs over this whole kind of biotechnological enterprise, almost as if it were a sword of Damocles. Now, in Meat Planet, I don't make it my project to say whether or not lab-grown meat is going to succeed, nor do I make a claim that it should or shouldn't succeed, that it's a good or a bad idea. And I'm very serious about this idea of not being a pundit or a critic, but rather an observer and commentator. On the other hand, it would be intellectually dishonest to say that I've collected evidence that suggests that cultured meat will imminently succeed. That is to say, being released on the market as a meat product and cutting into the market for traditional, conventional, in vivo, whatever phrase you want to use for the meat with which we're already familiar.
Bearing in mind that large-scale cultured meat is not a reality, that it's hype, break down for us how is meat grown in a lab? What initiates the process, and then how does it grow, you know, without the normal processes that we associate with an animal being born and all of that?
Yeah. I hope you won't mind my going back to the start of what you said. I don't think that lab-grown meat, or as I call it in my book, cultured meat, is just hype. I think that the hype cycle in which journalists and entrepreneurs and some scientists sort of collaborate to create a story out of a set of successful experiments in labs has done us a disservice, because it's left a lot of people with the impression that this already exists, But I think that the fact that it doesn't exist as a product doesn't mean that people aren't producing something that they call meat in laboratories, which is distinct. I think it's probably good to say for listeners, entirely distinct from the Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat, which are products many of us are becoming familiar with that are based on plant protein. To break it down, there's a tradition in creating facsimiles of meat and copying meat that we might call sensory equivalency. And that's the idea that when you create something to act as a surrogate for animal-derived meat, what you're copying isn't meat itself, but the sensation of consuming meat. So the mouthfeel, the taste, of course, the nutritional properties. Cultured meat is very different. Whereas the Impossible and Beyond Burgers work on a substrate of plant protein that has been processed and then, in a delightful word, extruded, although a lot of our food is one way or another extruded. Lab-grown meat is based on animal cells, usually satellite muscle cells taken in a biopsy from the muscle tissue, potentially of a still living animal, relatively unharmed with the removal of that biopsy of tissue. The muscle cells are then stimulated to begin a process that in a living animal is a process of muscular repair and healing. So the reason why when you get exercise, the muscle bulks up with repetitive exercise in a part of your body, you're essentially damaging or wearing the muscle that then regrows and heals stronger than it was before. So it's a process of it's a stem cell based process whereby muscle tissue not only repairs itself, but cells duplicate themselves, forming strands and then fibers and bundles of fibers to become the kind of complex muscle tissue that we're used to seeing in, say, a large terrestrial mammal like a cow or a terrestrial biped mammal like a human. All of this takes place in laboratory conditions, temperature controlled. The cells are usually in a series of not actually petri dishes, but what are called tea flasks. They're fed a growth media, which is complicated and which there's a lot to say about. And they're sometimes mechanically and sometimes electrically stimulated once they've become bundles of muscle to encourage them to grow further. Now, crucial question, is that meat? And that's where many of the people I interviewed for Meat Planet differ in their view. There are some muscle scientists who think that muscle cells that you grow in a lab are muscle cells you grow in a lab, that meat is still something else. And there are meat scientists who agree with them, saying that things qualify as meat when certain chemical transformations that are ongoing after slaughter and through butchery have set in. There are people who think that meat is one of those terms that's kind of a black box. It means what you put into it, and anyone can define it as they see fit. And the people from the cultured meat companies, by and large, want to say that what they're making is meat because it is, in I suppose they would say, biologically equivalent to in vivo animal muscle and fat tissue. There are other components as well. Fat's crucial because fat carries so much of the flavor of meat. But still, this question of definition hangs over all of this too.
And that, of course, is a whole realm unto itself of what is meat and of course, to do with these products, cultured meat, whether they would be palatable enough for anyone to want to eat them. But putting those aside, what motivates the creation of cultured meat? There's an argument that has been made that is about the ethics of eating animals, of slaughtering them and eating them. But there's also one which is to do with the impact of industrial animal agriculture as it's practiced today on the environment. Can you tell us about that argument and to what degree that is an important one in the support for developing cultured meat?
So these moral arguments are precisely where all of this seems to begin. And I need here to distinguish between what some of my colleagues would call actor narratives, that is to say, things people say about why they do what they do, or as opposed to other motivations that people can't or don't talk about, at least not to the press.
Sure.
Including the desire to, surprise, make money. The narrative about the defense of animal life has become influential in cultured meat circles. But the environmental explanation for why to do this is also extremely persuasive. Depending on whose assessment you use, industrial animal agriculture releases some 14 to 18% of our greenhouse emissions, considered as a kind of global civilization, per annum. We use about 75% of available agricultural land, either for livestock directly or to grow things we feed livestock. And as Francis Moore Lepay was pointing out in 1971, and it's still true today, it is inefficient to eat far away from the sun. In Diet for a Small Planet, Lepay offers readers feed conversion ratios for familiar animals that we eat and shows that cows are really dismal at converting land and water and calories to calories that humans eat. Still true. And at the moment, we have this kind of bizarre tragicomedy in Brazil in which, on the one hand, the Amazon is being destroyed in some cases to make room for cattle. And then you have, I believe, a minister claiming that Theodore Adorno wrote the songs of the Beatles. So it's a really odd, bizarre moment for commentators on environmental devastation to get to mention the Beatles and Adorno. But if it's true that industrial animal agriculture runs contrary to environmental protection, then it stands to reason that a reduction in the amount we rely on, especially beef, because cows are so environmentally destructive as animals to raise, but all kinds of industrial animal agriculture, stands to reason that we should be curtailing that and limiting that. As early, I believe, as 2011, we started to see, 2012, we started to see life cycle assessments, which were entirely hypothetical because they were about a non-industry, but life cycle assessments by proponents of lab-grown meat who wanted to show that it would use less land, less water, less energy, be, on the whole, environmentally more green. Those life cycle assessments then came under fire by certain critics. They were redone. Other groups, more neutral groups, theoretically neutral groups, have created their own life cycle assessments, some of which are less favorable to the idea of a cultured meat production process being more environmentally sustainable. So I would say that the environmental consequences of lab-grown meat are actually very much up for grabs, even though they remain one of the important selling points for this as a technology.
I'm speaking with writer and historian Benjamin Wargaft about his book Meat Planet, Artificial Flesh and the Future of Food. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Ben, in your book looks at, as the title suggests, the future of food and the complicated and contesting visions that we have about the future. And we'll be talking about that future, those futures, as we go on. But how we see the future often has a lot to do with how we think about the past. So I want to turn to the past and about how the lens through which we see how we've consumed meat in the past and what it represents to us. And I wanted to ask you about the claims that have been made that eating meat was a key part of our evolution. And in fact, in some cases, the argument goes, eating meat made us human. What do you make of such arguments and what they tell us?
The argument that eating meat made us human and has a lot of variations, some of which suggest that it didn't have to be meat. It could be any highly bioavailable proteinaceous substance that provided lots of calories and didn't cost a lot to metabolize. There are arguments that it was not meat alone, but cooked food in general that contributed to our sort of physiologically modern human condition. And the bioanthropologist most associated with that view is Richard Wrangham, whom I talk about in the book. The other way to view the relationship between meat and becoming human has to do less with diet and more with behavior. And a number of anthropologists in the 60s and 70s, but continuing today, viewed meat acquisition strategies, especially hunting, as really crucial in developing a modern human range of physiological, mental, and social capacities. Cooperation, aim, that is to say with a spear, the distribution of meat as a social strategy for winning status in a community, even winning or maintaining a mate. What's interesting about all of these arguments about the putative centrality of meat in our becoming sort of modern humans actually doesn't have to do with their correctness or incorrectness. That is to say, I expect evidence on all sides of these debates to continue piling up as paleoanthropologists do their field work, find faunal assemblages next to hominid encampments, and struggle with how to interpret evidence that's many more than thousands of years old in some cases. It has to do with how that evidence is marshaled. And towards the end of the book, I talk briefly about a kind of advertisement that flashed up briefly in my Twitter feed, I guess, as I was concluding my research for the book. And it was the Twitter feed, it was the Twitter account of someone named Josh Tetrick, who has for some time been the CEO of what used to be called Hampton Creek Foods and is now called Just. They made a vegan egg replacement. They make a variety of vegan food products. And for some time now, they've claimed to have a cultured meat product on the horizon. And what was so delightful about this advertisement was that it was a chicken nugget on a spear. And I tried to figure out exactly what culture the spear seemed to be from. It was not entirely obvious, but it seemed to be a pre-modern spear, and it was transfixing the chicken nugget as if somebody had been hunting for it. And this kind of fusion of pre-modern and explicitly industrial modern imagery seems to me to express a lot about why human prehistory is always marshaled as a way of supporting the quest to create meat in laboratories. And it has to do with the claim, a sort of claim about naturalness. It's a way of saying something that you could call sociobiological. That is to say, it's an effort to use a claim about biology to make a claim about our social lives, and often to make a claim about how we should be living. So it's a way of saying, yeah, it's right and good for us to eat meat because it's part of our heritage, biologically speaking. But hey, look, we have better tools than a spear now. We can lay down our spears, which I think was the slogan on that advertisement, lay down your spears, as if we in fact were hunters and gatherers, and take up a bioreactor instead.
Well, it's interesting some of those themes come together, that on the one hand, there's an awareness, a growing awareness of the costs of industrial animal agriculture ecologically. And at the same time, you've had the rise in the last 15 years And I'm sure one can trace the cycles of the emergence of these, of an argument that eating meat is most natural and tied to our hunter-gatherer past. And therefore, you see the rise of the people eating paleo diets and so on. But there's a justification about what is the most healthy because it's the most natural, it's how we evolved. And yet, for those who espouse that kind of position, the historical evidence doesn't really add up. So it expresses something that is much more complicated. How do you make sense of that?
I thought I was going to write a book about science and scientists, and I ended up writing a book about things people say about science, in a way. I fully expected to spend a couple of years in laboratories creating a rather academic laboratory ethnography. What do scientists do in the morning? What do they do in the evening? How do they get from that point A to that point B? And what does it all mean to them? And I ended up going to a lot of technology conferences and events and talking to venture capitalists and talking and working with professional futurists who are by and large business consultants of a certain kind, and trying to put together from all of these disparate sources the tools that would be necessary to write a kind of biography of an emerging technology that still hasn't emerged. And what I found was that this food of the future that doesn't exist yet but might was a kind of projection screen onto which people played their sort of personal films of how they thought the world should be. They thought it should be vegan, but they thought it should be delicious. They thought it should be a world of plenty in which we don't have to shrink our families or consume less or fly less or do anything less, really, except shift the substrate of production. Cultured meat is, in a way, Malthusian insofar as it thinks that there's something really wrong with what our appetites are doing to the potential for sustainability and for human welfare in the long run. But it's also to try to look at an anti-term of Malthusian. It's cornucopian in thinking that technology in the market can help us keep moving out of that sort of environmentally checkmated position.
Yes, and that's one of the really interesting themes that runs through this whole discussion of cultured meat in your book, Meat Planet, which is that these two threads, the Malthusian thread that sees scarcity around the corner and the cornucopian thread, you could say that both of these, the scarcity focused and the focus on endless growth, you can trace them through the history of capitalism, but certainly the cornucopian one has been also tied to a notion of endless growth and expansion in the market. And so I wanted to delve into these more. I wonder if you could start by talking about the first one, though, that you mentioned, about a way of seeing the future that has great anxiety about scarcity. It is associated with Thomas Malthus, although his argument around scarcity is a bit more complicated. Can you lay out that position, beginning with Malthus?
So Malthus's 1798 essay on the principle of population isn't about Soylent. It's not about the idea of a kind of vision of our food needs being purely caloric and nutritive. Although Malthusians rarely talk about it, Malthus was also operating from a sense of what he expected a population to want to eat, that they could eat and remain happy enough to not sort of foment revolt of one kind or another. And he was anxious about the forms of subsistence that he heard about in reports coming back from the British who had been in India and China, and from those who had been traveling in the colonies in the Americas, or formerly the colonies at that point. He was worried about stories about population growth, figures that he was seeing in reports that came in. He was anxious about what he and generations after him would call an Asiatic diet, which was presumed to be rice-based and to feature very little animal protein. And he took the beefsteak as a kind of measure of plenty, which at the time was beginning to be a rather British thing to do. And it presumed a certain model of eating, not pure calories or pure nutrients, as something that you would be, I suppose, working into your calculations as you did the math of the possibilities of food production versus population growth. Famously, Malthus holds that population increases exponentially, whereas food production increases merely by addition, so that population is always going to outstrip food production, leaving some portion of the population, the portion with the fewest resources, in a vulnerable spot vis-a-vis malnutrition and even starvation. So Malthusians to this day, Paul Ehrlich, who I think believe is still alive and writing, is maybe our most famous current global Malthusian. Of the population bomb, yeah, which he wrote with his wife, I believe, Anne, in the very late 60s, I believe, expecting widespread famine by the mid-70s, which the places where the Ehrlichs have lived did not see, but other parts of the world have. If the premise of Malthusianism is not merely that population growth is problematic and should be curtailed by various artificial strategies, which itself is a huge conversation and has led many Malthusians to charges of racism, rightly or wrongly, you then have the flip position, namely cornucopianism, suggesting that, in fact, Malthus was wrong, that production can even outstrip population growth. And Friedrich Engels himself, a critic of Malthus, would essentially, and usefully for this conversation, show us that not only capitalists have tended to think that certain forms of growth are possible and desirable and that progress will out. So in the book, although I'm very critical of capitalism and identify as a socialist myself, I try not to pretend that this is a capitalism problem alone. In a sense, it's a modernization and scale problem. And what cultured meat seems to me to seek to do is to get rid of the problem of our appetites, whether it's the appetite for food or the appetites that lead to more people, as it were, and say that, in fact, different production techniques can eliminate the undesirable, whether it's moral or environmental, externalities of having lots of meat around.
Benjamin Wargaft is my guest. We'll return with him in just a moment. Torture me. I'm just an animal, you see. On the slab for your lab, not upset. You know pets don't really feel. Torture me. Why don't you carve my body up? Throw me into a pot. Make it hot, and you'll have a lovely meal. Torture me, 'cause you're the beauty, I'm the beast. For your feast, weddings, bar mitzvahs and all. Torture me, take my skin, eat my flesh, 'cause it's fresh, boil or roast or be a bore. And if I can suffer more. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Benjamin Wargaft about his book, Meat Planet, Artificial Flesh and the Future of Food. That's published by UC Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that. His other books include Thinking in Public, and he's visiting assistant professor of social studies and history at Wesleyan University. So focusing on the cornucopian view of food, of the future, tell us a bit more about that perspective and the role that technology and often the market, although you have pointed out that this is not just a capitalist way of seeing the future. But tell us about within a framework of the present, how the centrality of technology and frequently the market for those who see the future as one of endless abundance.
It's very, very tempting to look at the etymology of capital, tracing it back to the Latin for head and head of cattle, cow. And sort of say that in some sense, anthropologically speaking, maybe this is about the root impulses behind capitalism. And Meat Planet could have had a sort of rowdy reading of Adam Smith on all of this. And I didn't go that route largely because to some degree it seemed obvious. It seemed already written into the case studies I was looking at, in which entrepreneurs wanted to take the possibility of using tissue culture techniques to make meat to not only get us out of a set of what they might call major global challenges, but also to make money. It just seemed obvious that that was part of what was motivating people. In 2013, when Mark Post unveiled his hamburger in a media event in London, and had a panel of tasters try it, the person who introduced him in a kind of promotional video made for that event was Sergey Brin of Google. And that association shaped a lot of the thinking that went into Meat Planet, because it was one of these surprising moments when, you know, the backer for this hamburger project that cost over $300,000 of materials and technicians' lab time to create turned out to be somebody whose fortune was based on something much less somatic, was based on the digital, and was based on the capacity for digital products to scale, as they often use that word as a verb, in the early 21st century. And I became curious if the kinds of expectations for growth that we often associate with technology companies were being projected onto the possibilities of lab-grown meat. If, in other words, animal parts, cells, were being asked to act like software. So the first chapter of the book, in an homage to William Gibson, is called Cyberspace/Meatspace, cyberspace being his term for an imaginary proto version of what became the internet, and meat space being what the hackers in his novel called the world that their bodies were fated to inhabit, often a negative or undesirable place. One of the things that's happened in the early 21st century is that we've seen what has been called famously limits to growth, usually imposed by the environment and often expressed through such ideas as planetary carrying capacity of humans. I wanted to ask in the book if cultured meat wasn't an effort to get out of evident limitations on our ability to continue producing more and more, not just food, but a particularly costly form of food as markets and populations continue to grow.
Well, it's interesting in that, as you're alluding to, that when we think about cornucopian views of the future of endless abundance and expansion, you know, they tend to be related to optimistic times. And I think it's be fair to say that the times we're living through are not optimistic. So on some level, while on the one hand, something like cultured meat is put forward as a sort of salvation of a kind, at the same time, it's very complicated because not, of course, that everyone who is involved in cultured meat has that cornucopian view, but you have indicated in the book that often those two go in hand in hand. So it's a more muted version of that view. And of course, technology plays this key role in making it possible. And you note that technology is often used, not exclusively here, to solve political problems. So rather than taking on those political problems, technology is meant to be the fix. How do you see that dimension of this story?
Well, I have to say that some of this comes out not in the story of cultured meat alone, but of the day-by-day and month-by-month cultural surround. So if in 2008, PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, decide to create a contest to see who can create the first piece of lab-grown chicken and sell it, bring it to market. First, I think it was $1 million prize for the first laboratory that could do that. Nobody ever collected on it. I think the prize was shut down in 2014. At that point, things like that, sort of techno-utopian fantasy versions of what they thought lab-grown meat was going to be like and how soon they expected it, it seemed more viable. But also, and really crucially for my story, there was something less problematic about selling the image of an alliance between technology and capital saving the world. So 2010, 2011, 2012, the idea of standing up and giving a TED talk about how technology plus the market were going to save animals or the rainforest or anything, I think was a less fraught proposition than in 2017, 2018, 2019, as we've entered this moment of Silicon Valley's never quite brutal enough, but somewhat brutal introspection following the aftermath of the 2016 election in the US and the fairly clear evidence of the role that social media played in shaping our senses of reality during that time frame. So in a way, as I finished the book, the bloom was very much off the rose. And when I started my research for the book, optimism was still somewhat more common in the circles I was traveling in. So that's one way in which that played out.
I'm speaking with Benjamin Wergaft. He is a writer and historian, author of Meat Planet. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, in terms of these contesting visions of the future and how complicated they are and the ways even a decade can shift things, I wanted to ask you about the recent past, because the idea of fundamentally changing the food system seems like a far away idea, given that kind of pessimism about future change. And yet, the kind of animal production system that we have is relatively recent in historical terms. I mean, this system of large-scale industrial animal agriculture. Can you just tell us about how much what we take as a given today, how recent, in fact, that is, tracing it from the mid-20th century?
One of the weird things about food is that most of the people I know tend to think of the things they eat as kind of eternal. The tomato's always been a part of Italian cuisine. Well, no, actually, prior to the Columbian Exchange, people living in what would eventually be called Italy had never seen a tomato. It's a New World crop. And yet, because of the ways in which I think humans tend to experience time, things that we are familiar with start to feel like they never began and they'll never end. This makes food a really interesting lens through which to view the actual versus the perceived passage of time. And the amounts of meat that people in the developed world consume on average per capita, are so greatly out of whack relative to what their great-great-great-grandparents likely were able to consume, that it's almost as though we're mis-sampling our species history when we think that the amount of meat we eat today is sort of natural or quote-unquote normal, whatever that word means. In the book, I try to say that if you were to zoom out onto a kind of timeline of our species history from the mid-19th century through the early 21st, it would look like a really weird blip, a blip whose other side we just haven't seen yet. Earlier in this conversation, you alluded to the ways in which problems related to food aren't just production problems, aren't just technological problems that, say, progress in agriculture might change or fix, but that they're also political. Another way to look at the history of meat is, and I don't do this in Meat Planet, actually, which is a regret, and it's something that I might do in future work, but is to look at the history of meat through the history of government intervention in meat markets and meat production. One team of historians wrote a great article illustrating that in three different countries in the Western world, in times of political upheaval, governments have gone from encouraging the production of meat with an eye towards plenty, with an eye towards producing enough so that everyone can have some, to providing subsidies to producers while regulating instead the hygiene of meat products. And the point of that research seemed to me to be that what E.P. Thompson once called a moral economy had dropped out of the picture, that the idea that enough for more of us as a principle for production and distribution had dropped out. So in the book, one of the things that I say is that when we turn to a kind of technological imaginary around cultured meat as a way of resolving perceived problems in protein supply for the future, for, you know, 2+ decades to come, what drops out of the picture frequently is the political character of things like food shortages.
Sure. And of course, as you're saying, so much of the ways that the debate tends to be about how our world is going to change in terms of food, concerns about disruption, concerns about ecological scarcity or the effects of global warming, most of the discussion then leads to, well, how do we avoid those problems rather than how do we change the system fundamentally, which feeds into these ecological questions. And so thinking then more narrowly within the realm that is being discussed, you know, if we were to picture the future, and there are many different ways to do so, what might we imagine could be the possibilities without this kind of large-scale change to the system, but if the production of animals for slaughter and human consumption were to stop being the main way that meat was produced, what might that look like?
I should say for the listeners that I myself am an omnivore, and I eat everything with great enthusiasm, and I consider myself, I talk about this in Meat Planet, I consider myself to be a hypocrite in some senses for doing this, because not all of the meat that I consume is from sources that I've followed through the production chain, and can say that I validate internally the lives and deaths of the animals whose parts I've consumed. I haven't always done that. I think that in many ways I'm of the devil's party and I have dirty hands, and I wanted to write the book with dirty hands, and also to say that I don't have all the solutions. I don't write as a pundit or advocate of a particular answer to the problem, but I do want people to have a clearer sense that there are things other than tweaking production that can be done And one of them is flat out to eat less meat and to not eat industrially produced meat to the extent that we can. And there are several points in the book in which I discuss images of meat sharing. One of them comes up because Patrick Martins, who wrote a kind of carnivorous manifesto, he's a slow food guy. He's a proponent of eating heirloom animals. He sort of describes in that book a vision of eating very small amounts of meat and always doing so communally, always doing so, you know, sort of well shared around. And there's another point in the book where I talk about this fantasy, really, but an appealing one to me, dreamt up by two Dutch bioethicists called The Pig in the Backyard. And The Pig in the Backyard is a kind of what if we actually had cultured meat technology fantasy, but it involves a community raising an animal together, growing some of its cells into pork, in this case, and eating it while continuing to be in a form of community with the animal. And I like that because it helps us keep in clear view the moral possibilities created by living with non-human animals and by sharing with other human animals. I think that short of cultured meat becoming a reality, we have at least the thought experiments that it makes available to us. And we can use those to ask hard questions about how we consume meat today, what assumptions that's grounded in, and how we might move away from some of those assumptions towards an environmentally more sustainable and, for some of us, more ethical. I happen to think there's no ethical defense of industrial meat production from the standpoint of cruelty to animals, through a better way of living together.
Well, whether cultured meat ends up being viable on a large scale and replacing industrial animal agriculture, or whether people take the turn to eating insects, which certainly is one avenue being explored in terms of alternative protein sources, presumably, but who knows, don't have the same ecological consequences as the system of industrial animal production, or if people just stopped eating much meat. One of the things that you flag in the book is fascinating is, of course, there is this enormous animal biomass on the planet now from this system of industrial animal agriculture. And if that system were to stop being necessary, we would still be living in a world that has been changed. Can you just give us a sense, and we'll end on this, on the degree to which the number of domesticated animals has exploded since 1900 and the possible worlds that we could be left with if that system came to an end?
Well, on this note, I'd like to read a little bit from Meat Planet, if I can impose on you and your listeners to do this.
Sure.
And this is from chapter 2, Meat, in the book. And as I'm reading this, I'm going to be thinking, some part of my brain is going to be thinking about the drive down the 5 from San Francisco to L.A., and you pass what is often called Auschwitz, which is horrible, but apropos, which is a major concentrated animal feeding operation right there off the highway, and you can smell it from the road. If cultured meat were adopted so enthusiastically that its architect's dreams were achieved, and it actually began to displace conventional animal agriculture, the Earth's animal biomass would be transformed in the process. The bulk of that biomass consists of domesticated creatures living and dying in our food system. The geographer Vaclav Smil has estimated that as of 1900, some 1.3 billion domesticated large animals existed on this Earth. As of 2000, the live weight of domesticated animals had increased some 3.5 times. Smil imagines sapient extraterrestrial visitors, those are his words, concluding on the basis of the sheer abundance of one creature in particular, quote, that life on the third solar planet is dominated by cattle. So we have, breaking off reading my book to you, we have this world in which a significant amount of the biomass on Earth is, in broader terms, anthropocentric. It's created by humans for human needs. We're every day entering further into a world in which we've remade more and more of nature and have brought more and more of the biological world, I guess we could call it, rather than resting on such a complicated word as nature, under our influence. Let's not say our control, because we know that, as has been pointed out by a famous movie mathematician, life finds a way. So if we were to move away from that, the consequences would have already been enormous for the kinds of creatures that we share the world with. If we were to move away from that via cultured meat, it would have consequences for the way we relate to life itself, in part because tissue culture relies heavily on what the historian of science Hannah Landecker calls the plasticity of life in vitro, the way we start to be able to induce cells to take on all kinds of new properties, to change shape, to live longer, to become each other under glass. So the consequences aren't just for nature, but crucially for our view of it. So moving away from dependence on industrial animal agriculture, beneficial in some ways, will also have its cultural complexities.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for joining me, Ben.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
I've been speaking with Benjamin Wergaft about his book, Meat Planet, Artificial Flesh and the Future of Food, published by UC Press. His other books include Thinking in Public, and he's visiting assistant professor of social studies and history at Wesleyan University. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.